All right, hey everyone, welcome to season three of Softcast. I'm your host, Sergeant Major Matt Parrish, and joined, as always, with the Command Senior Enlisted Leader of U.S. Special Operations Command, Command Chief Greg Smith. Chief, three seasons. Who would have thought we actually did not either get canceled or throw these mics and run away after doing so many of them? But I can tell you, I never thought we would do this, period. But I've had so much good come out of this from these conversations. Yeah. And I know you and I have talked about it often, but we've got an amazing opportunity today. So as you pilot this big ship, as the senior enlisted leader of U.S. SOCOM, we're constantly getting personnel in, right? And we've got someone hailing from your force today, from the U.S. Air Force. Talk us through a little bit. How did we end up pulling our guest in today?
Yeah, so quick backdrop on the first two seasons is, you know, what we thought this podcast was and what it kind of what it's become, it's kind of an evolution, right? And it's an evolution of thought, of our understanding, articulation of both scenarios, life through SOCOM's lens, right? And also kind of the contemporary issues and some great heroes that we've had as well. Yeah. So thinking about this, you know, we don't have anybody that really has a great story on like really interagency collaboration and how you can do really impossible things that's not combat, right? Mm. But it's as close to it as you're going to get because it's just as challenging. Yeah. And lo and behold, in my office for an in call was Senior Master Sergeant Derek Anderson, one of our pararescue men, kind of showing up here at Joint Special Operations University. And Derek has an incredibly interesting story to share today.
So, Derek, appreciate you making the short trip. We're excited to have you. So, a little background, Senior Master Sergeant Derek Anderson, he's a pararescueman. He's got about 18 and a half years in service. And what's interesting to me, Derek, you and I talked a little bit before we started rolling on this thing, the PJ community is a little bit different than like what, as an Army SF guy, I go through our qualification course, I go to one group, I might do an instructor tour, but I pretty much stay in SOF in that one unit. Whereas the pararescue squadrons, you all go back and forth, obviously into different units, but even into different like SOF and non-SOF assignments. So it's a very interesting career field. So I want to pick your brain a little bit on that. But first of all, thanks for taking the time. I know we pulled you sort of spur of the moment, but really happy to have you. We appreciate it.
Oh yeah, no worries. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So 18 and a half years. You're going back and forth between rescue squadrons, special operations, or special tactics squadrons. Walk us through quickly your evolution from joining to where we ultimately get there in July 2018, where you had a pretty amazingly difficult and complex situation in your hands.
Yeah, sure. So I actually grew up most of my younger life in South America. My mom and dad worked there. Yeah. And it was interesting because I always wanted to do something in special operations. I always liked the thrill of doing, you know, high risk things, especially serving, you know, your country. My grandfather was a pilot in the Air Force. So, you know, it definitely runs in our family. And about a year before I was going to finish high school, my dad had read an article about these guys that had done a rescue, and he started doing some research. And I was kind of set on going into the Navy and trying to be a SEAL. Yeah. And he had said, well, hey, you should check out, there's a job called pararescue that they also have a very, very tough selection, but they also have a different side of the mission where it's not all combat related. They do rescues as well. And, you know, and personnel recovery. So after doing research on the Air Force and the pararescue, you know, career field, and it being very, very elite and, you know, specialized and still being able to do certain things I wanted to do, I figured I would go that route. So I enlisted about a week after I turned 18. Yeah. Youngest guy by far. I was pretty bummed. My graduation, I was 20, so I had to wish everybody farewell at the bar that night. But then the rest, you know, I feel like has flown by. So my first assignment was a rescue squadron at DM, the 48th. I left there and went to kind of a unique assignment at the 6 SOS, where I went through combat aviation advisor training. Yeah. Spent a few years there. And then, yeah, did some time.
So foreign internal defense, but on the Air Force side, right? So similar to what we think about as a Green Beret mission or Raider mission is a, you know, foreign internal defense type of deal, but from the Air Force side, from the pararescue side?
Yep, absolutely. There was two of us there, PJs, yep, and like two combat controllers. And it was a unique unit because we were, you know, the minority. There was about 33 career fields, and we would go to all these different countries all over the world, you know, like you guys do, and train with their partner forces, their aviation SOF units. And so, yeah, that was a unique assignment. I really I think, got to really understand, you know, how important relationships were with other countries, right?
Yeah.
And really, the guy that you were working with 10 years ago is now a general who happens to work, you know, in Indonesia or Thailand or Poland. So,
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I was a staff sergeant then. It was real good to have that exposure young. And then, yeah, spent some time at the 2-3 STS where I did a lot of the you know, embedded deployments where I got to work with the Army, specifically mostly 7th Group. After that, did some time, instructor time at the Special Tactics Schoolhouse there at Herbert Field. Then Japan happened where I got orders because I had been at Herbert Field for almost 7 years. So during my time at Japan, I spent you know, most of my time in different positions, but it was all at the Special Tactics Squadron there. And that's when Thailand happened, summer of 2018.
I got to know, did you have the PJ hair before you went to the 2-3 or did that come when you were in the 2-3?
Yeah, you know, back, that was part of the recruiting process. Yeah. You had to like show them that your hair would
I wasn't sure if that was as an 18 and 20 year old, you had to learn that, or I know every 2-3 guy that gets attached to me has the PJ hair as a team sergeant. Pulling my own hair out as those cats would talk to the battalion commander and he would rain fire down on me as if, you know.
So he was in my office. He was in my office this morning, right? Yeah. And he was talking about the rest of his career.
Yeah.
And I was like, look what you have to look forward to. And he just looked at my hair and he went, nah,
yeah,
I'm
I can't
out.
Do that. He's like, I got a standard to maintain. I love, you know, kind of having that ability to talk through that part of your career, because I didn't really know about that. You know, I was in 7th Group for a long time. We had guys attached and I just assumed like PJ stayed in soft like we did. And then, you know, I got a buddy that's in reserve PJ and I started learning like some of that rescue thing. And obviously we think about, okay, there's folks that get stuck somewhere and need rescue. We've got the best in the world. So why wouldn't we employ those folks? And so I know you were in Okinawa there for a little while, that you said, and then you guys got a call from SOCPAC or the Special Operations Command for the Pacific Theater, or TSOC or Theater Special Operations Command for sort of the Asian continent and Indo-PACOM is what it's, you know, known as now. But you get a call, there's a situation going on. Talk me through that initial kind of warning call and what you guys did to mobilize to go to Thailand.
It was early, you know, I think 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. Some of us had just arrived at the gym and it was an interesting chain of events because there wasn't a whole lot of information. It was like, hey, there's some kids stuck in a cave. And I said, okay, well, why are we going to have to fly, you know, over to help them? Like if they're stuck in a cave, and they're like, well, it might be flooded. And so the information was kind of, you know, cause it came through the embassy to, I think Hawaii initially, and then down through SOCPAC. So by the time it got to us, it was like, hey, how fast can you be ready? I said, well, 2 hours, you know, and we at that point went full motion. I grabbed myself. Major Charles Hodges had literally just taken command, I think 2 weeks prior, that. And he's like, all right, let's go. And so we grabbed our equipment that we thought we would need, you know, the confined space, structural collapse, dive equipment, and headed to Thailand. So, but, you know, by the time we got notified to when we were in the cave, dumping rain in Chiang Rai, it was about 17 and a half hours. So
it's phenomenal.
Yeah, so 17 and a half hours, I mean, from basically phenomenal. From flash to bang, right? And this is where it becomes important from special operations. I think what makes our command and all of our, what I call our action figures, right, the operational units, what makes a difference is their ability to have all of that pre-training and kit and gear ready to go, right? And I know that in this case, it's a pretty unique one.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we talk about all the time and it we're always trying to fight complacency, and we always talk about you never know when the last time you're doing it in training is, you know, you assume you're going to go to the range again tomorrow. But what if you get that call at 5 a.m.? So talk to me a little bit about structural collapse, confined space, those kits, but really how often you all had already been training together as an element, or was this, hey, we've all trained apart and now we're coming together as a team?
Yeah, so we obviously, at the Special Tactics Squadrons, especially nowadays, train together on most core tasks that are similar. So diving, jumping, tactics. The confined space structural collapse is definitely more PJ-ish, you know, where we have our confined space air monitors. We have cameras that we use. You know, examples of where PJs have done a lot of that would be like Haiti, you know, where you have large earthquakes where people are still alive and we're having to try to figure out in a very short amount of time if we're going to explore a building or not. So we had a lot of that type of equipment, you know, shoring equipment. But in this cave, it was a little different because it wasn't necessarily a collapsing cave. It was just filling.
Yeah.
And that part got very tricky because I had never been in that, you know. I've been through combat dive school in Key West, and I have done the water confidence drills. But this was cave diving is such a different animal than any of the special forces diving that we go through because it's just so dangerous. The equipment setup's different. And a lot of that education came after, you know, we arrived.
Sure.
So we had brought a lot of our diving equipment. But what was crazy was like some of the key pieces of equipment that literally saved the day were like our full face masks that we use, right? Like who would have thought that in the history of sedation and anesthesia that you could actually bring someone underwater alive?
Yeah.
And now fast forward, zero visibility, freezing water, and be able to resedate them over the course of 3 to 4 hours was just, you know, it was an unprecedented event. So I think that, you know, when it comes to like maintaining your equipment, having everything ready, you know, it's very important that, you know, the equipment that's on alert is continually maintained. Yeah. And up to date for when things like that happen, we can get out the door quickly.
Yeah. I want to back up a minute for two things. One, we talked a little bit about sort of the rescue part of it, but I don't think we touched on enough that really like one of the bread and butter things of pararescue is medical training, right? Like we have 18 deltas or medics on our teams. You know, obviously we've got medical specialties across every formation of special operations, but really as pararescue, that was part of what we really got out of having PJs attached to us in seventh group was having another really competent medic that we knew could get us out of situations and things like that, but really just provide care. But also, can you set the stage for us a little bit on that cave and what was going on? So I know we talked about there's 12 boys and a coach, they're stuck in a cave, but when you get there, what's the initial sit rep that you get that tells you like, all right, this cave is filling and all that?
Well, yeah, so we landed about 1 o'clock, 1:30 in the morning. I sent the team to get a few hours of sleep, and myself, Jamie Brisbane, and Major Hodges headed to the cave. And we did a quick link up, and it was pouring rain. Mm-hmm. And I remember walking down. The SEALs had already been there for about 2 days, but they had
The Thai SEALs.
Yeah.
Had been there for about 2 days, and were getting driven back because the cave kept filling up. It was almost like if you were to imagine the plumbing of a toilet, right? Parts of the cave had sumps. And so as the children went in, when it was dry, they had done this before, right? People were like, why would they go into a flooded cave? It was dry. The sump had flooded from the other direction, which blocked their exit. So as we were coming in, probably about 300 to 400 meters into the cave, they were walking us back to where sump one would be on the map that we drew. This wall of water came, and all of a sudden I saw it rise probably 6 inches in the 30 minutes we were there, and we had to basically leave the cave. And they asked if we could come back at 8 o'clock in the morning where a lot of the leadership were going to be present. And that was kind of the intro to the cave, right? It was this massive, you could almost fit a C-130 in the front of it. And then there was parts where, as you get back into chambers 2, 3, and then even past 4, you're crawling through with barely enough room to get your body through. So was the size difference of this thing.
Yeah, incredible. And that's why I wanted to set the stage, because I know this was, you know, international huge news. Yeah,
but at this point, the Thai Navy SEALs are there. Mm-hmm. The Thai government's there. Who else is there right now? Sorry, you guys are the first U.S. operational force there, correct? I mean, who else is there when you show up?
Just some local rescue volunteer teams. The Thai SEALs had been there trying to help. There was some other Army, some Thai Army folks there. And then right before us, Rick and John, the two Brits that were, you know, very instrumental in the rescue, they arrived just a few hours before us as far as foreigners getting on site.
And we'll just for the audience, we'll attach a link at the end of this that actually goes to about an hour long YouTube documentary. And there's also a documentary on Disney Plus right now. But there's a YouTube documentary from Australia that's really, really well done that depicts all of this.
Yeah. So you're thrown into this situation where not only is the situation on the ground sort of amorphous and uncertain about how you know, how much that cave's going to fill out. But you also got sort of unknown manpower and personnel as all these different elements start showing up to try to help, right? So talk us through that next morning. You come in. How are you getting into the next kind of phase of that operation?
So the next morning, we were back, I think, around 8 o'clock in the morning, and now a lot of the cameras were there again. So yeah. It was like, you know, here's the U.S., you know, military, and they're here to save the day. And it was interesting because I don't think a lot of people realize that in some of these other countries, they think that some of the Hollywood stuff that happens in movies is really how we act. And it's funny because we came in and we were just meeting the leadership, right? There was a governor there. There was a few generals, and we sat down and they said, okay, what equipment can you provide us? You know, like the secret sauce. And they were like, maybe the satellites can come over and you can see through the mountain and then just tell us where they are. And it was like, you know, some of these Jason Bourne movies had really, you know, taken effect. And I think that for us, it was like, okay, well, right now there's so many people and there's a bunch of chaos. And there was a lot of different kind of moving parts. There wasn't really a task organization. There wasn't unity of effort, you know, and that's where we came in and said, okay, well, I don't have the super secret satellites that can see through mountains. I don't think any country does yet. I said, but what we can provide are these things. And we went through the equipment we had, and then we asked, you know, who was there respectfully, right? And a lot of this comes down to your cross-cultural communication, right? I had spent time in Thailand when I was at the Sixth. I had understood that the relationships and the culture were very important. And ultimately, as you know, we talk about the rescue, you'll see that, you know, when we were briefing the highest levels to get approval for this with a 50% casualty rate and still having the trust of a foreign government was incredible. So, you know, building those relationships early, I think, was important. And then just kind of walking with them step by step. Okay, what day are we on? So it's day four. So if they're alive, where could they be? And that's where there was a volunteer named Vern Unsworth who was like obsessed with this cave. And he was able to give us a very rudimentary map of like where they might be, right? And at that point, we just started establishing very methodical courses of action with him. Okay, well, we'll have a dive team. We'll have a alternate entrance to the cave team. We'll have a drilling team, right? A pumping team. We were just kind of going down the list. This was one of those like, okay, well, right now the rains are so bad that the diving wasn't working well. So instead of sitting there, you know, we started to get very creative. And there wasn't really, by the second and third day, this started to become so big, it wasn't a shortage of resources or manpower. Yeah. It was almost, it was the opposite. Everybody wanted to help, and it was becoming dangerous, you know, at one point.
Right there. Let me stop here. This is the point, I think, of this one, of the first 24 hours of assessing who's here and then trying to figure out, as we have never met a crisis we have not fallen in love with. We haven't. And everybody flocks to it as it starts to gain, and it becomes harder and harder. It's not a resource issue at that point. It's a command and control issue. Otherwise, you'll start walking off course really quick. So I think Derek and his team and Major Hodges and the team advising the Thai leadership, who was in charge, that was the true value there of how do you be a great team player and advisor. Fair?
Well, and 100% what we always want to talk about how great we're at is the tactical skill of actually doing the diving and the pumping and everything else. But this is one of those situations that, to your point, 100% highlights how important it is to be able to do some of those other reps in planning and command and control, because all of a sudden you went from lifting one day in the gym thinking you're coming in, and all of a sudden you're running an international rescue effort, or at least advising, as you said, the folks that were in charge. But it's the proficiency of the U.S. team at that point in having done similar things and being able to walk it down the line and say, hey, these are the steps that we need to take. So talk us through as you start trying to keep it from being a dangerous situation where everybody wants to have their hand in the pot. What's the next step there?
Yeah, so a perfect example was like early on, and maybe not a lot of people know this, but there was almost four other casualties.
Wow.
And no one even knew that there were some just civilian volunteer rescue workers that were already trapped. Remember, I said the flooding got real bad. Well, they were found by Rick and John in Chamber 3, which ended up being our dive base. Yeah. And no one even knew they were in there. They had been in there an entire day. So having them be rescued and then kind of taking a step back and saying, okay, we have to have someone at the cave. Let's put a whiteboard here. And, you know, some people think that You know, this was 2018. It's not too long ago,
yeah.
But we did not use very much technology. And I always go back to the basics, right? Yeah. We got the whiteboards out. We got a lot of our checklists out. Like we were in a muddy jungle, forward staged, and ultimately using the military decision-making process, right, the joint planning process, and just kind of going through and methodically, especially in the beginning when the options seemed very grim.
We hadn't even located the boys yet. All we knew is their bikes. We found their bikes by the cave entrance, but they didn't know how far back this. We didn't know about Chamber 7 or any of those things yet. Like he said, we found the two divers in Chamber 3, which ended up being base camp, right? I mean, really, at the end of the day, inside. So kind of walk us through, if you could, okay, from chaos to some of the situations to when we find actually confirm that the boys are there.
So, you know, over the next course of, I think it was 7 to 10 days, it was long and grueling days, right?
Sure.
And every day would be a little grimmer if we didn't find them. But a couple things that I'm going to highlight that were big, right, was having the mindset of never quitting and persevering every day, because a lot of people were looking to the international team as, you know, between us and the Thai SEALs trying to tackle this impossible problem, and it was getting grimmer and grimmer. But something happened where an individual named Thanet said, "Hey, if I can help divert water, rainwater, you know, I have a almost like a business in finding and, you know, locating water and you know, studying hydrology." And with even PVC pipes and sandbags, he was able to go divert a fair amount of water, which started letting the divers get further in. And Rick and John, you know, we would sync up multiple times a day.
Yeah.
And they were like, "Yeah, man, we're making good progress right now. And we're already past," like they called it, the T-junction. And I said, "Well, Vern said that if they were alive, there's only like these two or three places where the cave wouldn't completely flood where they could be." And I knew that, you know, that was starting to get closer and closer. But the thing on all of our minds were how can a child survive in this environment with no food or water for, we were going on 10 days, you know? So just keeping the team motivated, keeping them on task, right? Every day we were putting in 24 hour operations, and we were still full steam. There was still pumping happening. There were drills being brought in. We were clearing helicopter landing zones to bring in drills because we were just going to keep working this problem. Even if it became a rescue to a recovery, our mission there was to bring the kids out. So we were working on those three different COAs, but as the diving one started to progress and the water was really slowing down, and now we had a base camp in Chamber 3 where we had about 100 plus tanks forward stage at this point, we were starting to make really good progress.
Oxygen tanks for scuba, right? For all your underwater.
Yep. So, there were compressed air tanks that the divers were using for, you know, going through these sumps, right? Some parts they had to wade, some parts they had to dive, some parts they had to walk.
Yeah.
It wasn't all just one dive. So you had a bunch of different skills involved. But then about 10 o'clock at night, you know, Rick and John, the famous YouTube video that was released shortly thereafter where he's like, you know, "How many of you are there?" And he says 13, and they're counting them 1, 2, they're all coming down the hill. And it was a miracle. You know, they really, truly had to, I couldn't imagine being in that environment for that time, especially with the coach and keeping the kids, you know, their mindsets, their abilities to survive like that, drinking the runoff water from the cave and literally having almost no food the entire time. So I think at that point it was a huge relief, but the scary part was that the world was rejoicing, and Rick and John pulled me aside the next day and they're like, "Hey man, we opened Pandora's box." Like, "I don't think we can get them out." Like, this is very difficult diving, not for us, but for them, it would be almost impossible. It was a long, long morning because everyone's celebrating. The vast majority of the camp didn't know that the kids may not still make it out. But the video had shown, you know, we were like, "Hey, it might not be wise." But you know, the excitement and the parents were there. And so now the parents were rejoicing and the burden just became bigger and bigger on our shoulders where I was like, "Man, we owe it to these kids, you know, we owe it to Thailand, like as an international team, to put every single ounce of energy towards this." So we did. We sat down and started going through crazy amounts of like details of logistics of what it would take to physically get one child the amount of air Sedation hadn't come up yet because it was still a touchy subject, but Rick and John kept going back to, we almost drowned getting those volunteers out, and that was 50 feet.
Yeah.
And they said, there's no way we're going to be able to do this unless, he just kept saying, you know, sedated, but we didn't know how much right. or what drug yet.
So
you
let's,
know?
Yeah, put that yeah, in context. Yeah, yeah. So the volunteers from Chamber 3 that they got out from 50 feet, how far were they?
They
so compare the difference in the 50 feet to a half a mile.
Oh yeah, the diving portions where they had to bring them through that were just short dives, 50 feet or less, they almost died in those sections, just because of the environment was so different and so dangerous, you know, to non-cave divers.
Yeah, I want to touch on something before we continue down that line of the importance of the leadership and positive mental attitude that you touched on earlier. One for the coach and the kids in there, but also for you all. You know, it's something we talk about when we go places and we're working with partners. You know, if you come to a range event with one of our teams, you're going to hear a lot of complaining and a lot of like, this is messed up. This is and rightly so, right? Like one of the greatest things about SOF is that good enough's never good enough, right? That's what I love about it. But we have to realize that when we're somewhere else, it doesn't matter if you're in a leadership position or not. Every single person that's in that space is an ambassador of the United States of America. So maintaining, as you all said, it became more and more daunting not letting yourself get pulled into that, because as soon as the Americans would have turned their heads down and said, oh man, this is impossible, it would have started down that way. So first off, that's an incredible lesson for all of us to remember as we're ambassadors. But then as you then have this triumphant moment, I remember that when that came out, and then it was still like, oh no, they found them, but they're not out yet. And so now as you start making that plan, and now all the weight of the world literally is on your shoulders, like now we've seen these kids, how do we get them out? So you start talking sedation. When does that plan start to further materialize? How much further into that?
So Rick and John had come to me, right? Like they were our resident. I mean, we became very close because sure. most of the time they were there from the beginning and we worked so closely, but I had to truly understand the risk, right? As you're looking at ORM and they were explaining to me step by step, like everything that we would have to go through, you know, it's just incredible teamwork. We were working jointly every day and developing this plan. And they said, look, they have to be sedated. So that's the only way it's going to work. And they thought I was going to be kind of shocked and say, well, you want to, and then I said, like, I was just quiet thinking about it for a minute. And I said, okay. And then, you know, I started brainstorming all the different ways of possibly keeping someone breathing, you know, the drugs that we could use. And and they used their resources. Dr. Richard Harris, which is a good friend of ours now, is also a cave diver, you know, the unicorn cave diver anesthesiologist. So, you know, Rick had been messaging with him. I reached back to our career field medical director at the time, so Dr. Stephen Rush, a good friend of mine, and he was like, all right, I'm going to put it out to the pediatric anesthesiologists, and we're just going to get a feel for dosing, drugs, you know.
That's and then, crazy.
And as that was happening, I said, hey, the wheels have to continue with this. Like, we knew bad weather was coming, and if the rains came back the way they did, they were going to flood the dams we had built, and they would basically refill parts of the cave where we needed the water to be low to do a mask change or a tank change. And so the plan was also pending on that the monsoon rains would hold off, you know, a few more days, hopefully a week. So as we were developing this plan, it became, you know, more and more obvious that they were going to have they were going to have to be sedated. It was going to be extremely risky. And then we started doing what we do best, right? Rehearsals. And we got our full face masks. We had the air monitors that we had taken in. We brought in 100 of our MREs. We're like, hey, these kids are in a bad state. And so they brought 100 high calorie MREs, started feeding them, right? Yeah. Here's some water pumps that we had, get them fresh water.
Nice.
If they're going to, their bodies are going to survive this journey, we have to get them back up. So that's what they did, you know, for about a week. The Thai SEALs that swam back there with them and Dr. Pak were there with them as their kind of their, you know, chaperones, and we're taking care of them every day and getting them fed. And as that was happening, we were building the A team, right? So I asked them, hey, if you could bring in, you know, because at this point, and I'll just touch briefly just because I think it's important. Simon Cunanan had passed, and he had ultimately, you know, sacrificed his life in trying to help bring equipment back.
So this is a Thai Navy SEAL.
Yep.
It shows you the high risk. A highly qualified Thai Navy SEAL lost his life in those chambers, in those sump pumps, if you will.
Yep. It just goes to show, if you have an emergency in that environment without having three or four redundancies, you know, like the way that the cave divers' kits are built, unlike ours, it's almost fatal. So, you know, that truly highlighted the need to have very niche cave divers do the highest risk portions. And Rick and John said, well, I can count on one hand the people I would trust for this mission. And that's what we did. We went and asked, you know, the authorities, hey, these are the people we need. This is where they live. That's where Dr. Harris and Dr. Challen brought up from Australia.
Yeah.
And we just started piecing together this team of very different people from all over the world. We had a couple of our support divers. That one was Canadian, one was Danish, one was from Finland. And it was like this crazy group of people. And ultimately, we were the faces of it, right? But let's be honest, it was 1,000 people helping every day, right? Yeah. Doing laundry, food, the espresso machines they brought up to the cave to keep us, you know, caffeine high. Like, it was just incredible, the volunteering that was happening. And so I just would like to touch that, you know, there was some smaller people at the front of this rescue, but it was an overall huge lift. And the government of Thailand was incredible. Like, I kind of joke, but us being Americans, they were like, well, they must love McDonald's. And one day, they flew up McDonald's from Bangkok.
That's awesome.
It's awesome, though. But the hospitality, going out of their way to make sure you felt comfortable, or what they perceived would help you, was incredible.
And the network that you guys were able to mobilize, not just there on the ground of that incredible 1,000-person at least force that's keeping you going, but even reaching back into the States for some of that pediatric anesthesiology and really just mobilizing a global network to try to figure out, okay, this is as wicked a problem as we can possibly get. Like Chief said at the beginning, outside of combat, but with every bit as much stress, everything else, because lives are on the line. Lives have already been lost at this point, right? And so we're feeding them. We're getting them to where their bodies hopefully will be able to withstand this. I probably shouldn't say crazy plan, but this crazy plan we're having to do to surmount these crazy odds. So talk to me as you start feeling like, okay, we're getting ready to kick this part of the actual rescue off.
Yeah, so I think we had internally thought we were like an 80% plan. You know, the big things that put my mind at ease, if you could put your mind at ease in this situation, was that we had gone to a pool with some volunteer Thai children and had spent an entire day rigging them up and swimming with them and figuring out, all right, how is their hands going to go? Are the masks going to go? We were trying on, and it was incredible. If you set these masks that we had to a higher PSI, the overpressure would keep the water out, right? So I said, well, this might actually work. Like, this is incredible.
Yeah.
And we have videos, you know, and you guys can see in the documentary, The Rescue, or the YouTube link, where there's walkthroughs of the pool. There's walkthroughs of us swimming with these children, trying on the different equipment. And once that was successful, I thought we were almost at a briefing point where, you know, the rescue might actually happen. But there was one individual that really helped us, and he was an American civilian named Josh Morris. And he said he had been working with us. Some of his guys were rope experts. And he said, yeah, I don't think people realize the severity and where you guys are at. And I said, well, I would love to brief this thing, because we as a team right now are like 95%. And we have maybe 3 or 4 days before the range is supposed to come. And we think we can do maybe 6 a day. Initially it was 6 a day, but then we were like, we don't have the masks for 6 a day. And Dr. Harris said, yeah, we should do 4. You know, I mean, he was ultimately, when I look at heroes, like these were civilians that were assuming more risk than I've ever seen. And not just that, the moral courage for him to possibly be sending these kids to their death, but knowing that there was no other way, right?
Yeah.
And so it was just real heavy that night. We finally got a briefing with the Minister of the Interior, and, you know, it was just key personnel and leadership, and we briefed our plan very unemotionally, but it was very, very high risk, if you will. And I remember a very key moment when they said, you know, what do you think this success is? Like, well, define success for us. And, you know, Major Hodges said, well, I think we're at 50%. if we could get half of them out alive, that would be success. Yeah. And they were initially, you know, pushing a zero risk option. And I remember saying, like, sir, I know this sounds very grim, but right now I promise you, if we try to leave them in there, because that was the talk, right? We're going to leave them in there.
Through the monsoon season.
Through the monsoon season for 8 months.
Yeah. 8 months.
Yeah.
Yep.
In a cave with MREs. And,
right.
Yeah.
Well, you wouldn't have even been able to swim against the cave once those flows started again. And I could show you guys pictures after, like, that cave flooded and stayed flooded. Like I said, it was never a viable option.
Right.
But again, the risk was so high that it was like, I looked at him and I said, if we could get one out alive, that would be success.
More than what we're going to get if we do nothing.
If we do nothing.
Yeah.
Because part of this became, who's going to be the one that gets blamed when kids start dying, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And is it going to be Dr. Harris? Are we going to go to, you know, are they specifically, the civilians, going to have to spend the rest of their lives in jail here in Thailand, right? These were all very real questions because a lot of unknowns were briefed still. We said this has never been done in the history of any rescue. This has never been attempted. I said, but I can promise you this. This is your best shot. We have the best people in the world right now. We have spent 2 weeks training, rehearsing. We even did a rock drill for them the next day, rehearsal concept, and we walked them through. And initially people thought it was kind of elementary, some of the civilian divers, but they saw how valuable it could be because we even had, one of the plans was that they were going to bring oxygen up and try to run an oxygen line all the way back to where the kids were. So we had all this medical oxygen, and I said, well, this isn't a deep dive. Why don't we just use the O2 mm-hmm. for the kids' tanks? That way, if something does happen, they'll be completely saturated with oxygen.
Yeah.
And like that was just something that worked that we did. We were able to jam. So the kids' tanks were labeled differently. They were getting like almost 80% O2 versus the regular divers. It was just all these little things that we had built into the rock drill. They all watched the rock drill. And I said, hey, does this mean we're good? And that's when I said, yep, you guys are approved to execute your plan beginning tomorrow. And that was it. We all kind of took a deep breath. We went through the full scheme of maneuver of how it was supposed to play out, right? Roles, most importantly, roles and responsibilities.
Yeah.
It was pretty much calm out the second you left Chamber 3.
Oh, man.
And it was sticky notes. We had the sticky notes with the divers.
So, Derek, how far from Chamber 3 to where the boys were, how much time, how much time is that calm out? There and back.
Oh, you're looking at 5 to 6 hours.
So think about that. It's almost like launching to space, right? To the dark side of the moon. Like, okay, good luck. We've got you to this point. We'll talk to you again in 6 hours. If anything happened along the way, we would have no idea.
There's so many amazing parts of the story, but one of them being getting the clearance to do it that you talked through. Like, there's so many times where you might have the best plan in the world, but being able to articulate that in the risk management system to folks that are in a vacuum away is equally as daunting at that time right there. So to get that thumbs up, had to initially feel like, oh, great, we can do this, but then we're actually going to do this. So as you go into that next day and you start that first dive, talk me through what you're thinking as the first salvo of divers is going in. What's going through your head?
Yeah, who went into what caves? Like, because you were in Chamber 3 all the way to the point where you said, okay, good luck. See you in a couple hours.
Yeah.
Right?
What's going through your head there?
Yeah, so the days of the rescue, I stayed up at headquarters with Major Hodges, and we were C2ing it. You know, our joint center there with the Brits, the Australians, the Thais, and we were all kind of there. We knew that there was going to be 9 divers to go forward past Chamber 3, and that we had support divers assigned in certain sections that were going to help with tank swaps and medication bumps. We also knew that we had sections that needed a litter, like to drag them over the rocks.
Yeah.
So the plan was to send, Harry was going to basically sedate the first child. He was going to go, and they were going to swim him to Chamber 8. If he was alive, we were going to send a swimmer to say, okay, it worked.
Mm-hmm.
He's alive. We're going to continue with number 2, number 3, number 4.
Yeah.
Well, again, Dr. Harris, being the, hero that he is, was nerves were so high. He sent the first one and then sent the second one before the feedback loop was complete.
Yeah.
And it was crazy because there was this long, long pause. And I kept thinking to myself, okay, well, it's going to be really good or really bad.
Right.
And the plan was like, okay, if it doesn't work once, we're going to stop. and we're going to reevaluate. Yeah. We're not going to keep killing kids because, you know, this, we think this plan should have worked.
Right.
So that's really what it came down to was it, we would get him fully kitted up, right? He would give him a little Xanax to calm him down, the ketamine, and then asleep. And it's crazy because when you talk to the kids, they just felt like they took a nap. That's how good the plan ended up working was they woke up in the hospital and were like, wow, this is, and you know what's funny is people are, well, how did they decide to come out? They let them decide. They basically started choosing. The kids that lived the furthest away thought they were going to have to ride their bikes home. So they sent them out first.
It's perspective, man. I love it. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Some things are really simple, aren't they?
Yeah, it's incredible.
But, okay, so I'm hinging on this, right, because you said Dr. Harris sent the first two out first. But this is really about tactical innovation. Give people a really hard problem, and you are innovating on the fly, and you're innovating within innovation here. So first kid pops out, what happens?
Yeah, so there was this line, right, that would come all the way up to chamber three, and Captain Terrell was our forward, Stowe at the time, special tactics officer, and he was basically, by this point, you know, we had two types of communication. It was like an old school phone that you would see that people would wind, like those still exist. One of those was in there. And then they had ran this cable for internet.
Yeah.
So there was a connectivity back to chamber three, this waterproof cable. And so he said, fish on, right? That was the term we discussed. Hey, this is the first kid. And it was a long, quiet pause. And we said, all right, make it or break it. And he was like, pulled him out. And he was like, he's fine. He's alive. We did the assessment on him right there. It was boom, boom, boom. Had him on a litter. And then he had to go through another, right? After the diving, there was still multiple portions of the cave they had to make it through. So we had a bunch of people from chamber three all the way to the mouth of the cave. I walked down to the mouth for the first one, and I was just glad I did because the masks, they wouldn't open to ambient air. So once the tank would be empty, you know, that would be it. And mm-hmm. the first child, because everybody was so excited, his tank was almost empty. And I remember, you know, thank God, one of the divers, Jason, said, hey, just double check the tank. And he was like down to maybe 5 minutes of air. And I was like, okay, real quick adjustment. Hey, make sure you do tank swaps at two or three.
Yeah.
Right. And then number two came out alive. Number three came out alive. Number four came out alive. And we were like, all right, I don't know what just happened. You know, like the levels were high, but then it was like, okay, well, the range are still coming and we have, you know, nine more people. So there wasn't a ton of time for celebrating, right? It was right back to, okay,
absolutely.
Debrief. You know, we talked about the places guys should have been. There was a couple small errors in the plan where a guy wasn't where he was supposed to be. You know, we talked about sending the kids two at a time versus waiting. Mm-hmm. And then we talked about how we could just clean up the times a little bit better, make it faster. And then that's what happened the second day. Again, we sent four the exact same way, but it was dramatically faster. I think we reduced the times by about 30 to 60 minutes. And then the last day, the last five, you know, and it was like, talk about crunch time. You know, a lot of people were talking, well, are they going to make it before the rains? You know, is this actually going to happen? And it was just incredible to see that, like, as we were bringing the last people out, like some of the pumps started to fail.
Wow.
That those next days, the rains came back, you know, and it was like this, it was almost like, you know,
if
you're a spiritual person, like that we were given a window and that, absolutely, you know, that the kids' will was to survive. And it was incredible.
Yeah. I mean, a miracle, and not, you know, not to take away any of the, invalidate any of the work and all the things we talked about, but you know, as a spiritual person myself, sometimes there's a window and you start seeing those things and it becomes sort of eerie where, now everything's falling apart and the rain's starting and we just got them out. I mean, I'm sort of speechless on this, Chief. I mean,
so if you watch it, you know, and I know, Matt, you haven't had a chance to rewatch the video, but, you know, I think it's Rescue, right? Is the name of the one on Disney Plus?
Yeah, The Rescue. Yeah.
The Rescue. So if you get a chance, go to The Rescue on Disney Plus or on, you can go to Wikipedia and just type Thai Cave Rescue. Yeah. And down at the bottom under links, there's a link called Out of the Darkness, which is an Australian 55-minute YouTube video, which is also very, very good. Both really, really good. Derek, I know you're in both of those that offer some really good insight. But it when you get a chance, like no kid, like I have chills up the back of my neck just because Derek was coming to do an office call. So I just happened to watch it last week when I knew he was coming to do an office call. I was like, hey, I haven't watched that in a while. So I watched it, you know, just so we could catch up on that. And I think as you heard kind of Derek share his story, how tremendously powerful it is, you know, as we kind of get close to wrapping up here, Derek, a couple questions for you, then Matt, I know you got a ton, but, what were the biggest things you learned, you know, from this, and how, if you're now a leader, what would you tell young special operators or, you know, PJs today about the unknown and always being ready? So thoughts, what did you learn and what advice would you give?
Yeah, those are good questions, Chief.
That's why I asked him. I ask him a lot of really good questions from time to time, in between all the stupid ones I know.
You know, I would say don't ever overlook the basics, right? This rescue was a very, very complicated rescue, but we did the basics well, and that was really, you know, the equipment prep, the alert, the rehearsals, the walkthroughs, the planning. Everything was done, you know, by the book on whiteboards. It was just sticking to the basics and truly trusting the process would be the first one. The second one I would say is don't ever let anybody tell you something's impossible. You know, there's this line in the movie, and I don't really remember saying this, but they they said I said it, where they were like, yeah, this is going to be impossible. And I remember just pausing and looking at them and saying, well, what does the impossible look like? Mm-hmm. This is an impossible rescue. And we started chewing it off one bite at a time. And I think that, you know, with some of the daunting things people might face, not just in civilian but combat-type mission sets, just keep that mindset, right, where if you truly, truly believe and you truly understand that through teamwork and perseverance, it's and mindset especially, you know, which is not new to special operators, but it's just – this was one of those long, it's the longest mission of my career, right? Like, it's so funny. You think of operations where we've done in the Middle East, and usually we're in and out in a day, maybe two max, right? And here I am on almost 2.5 weeks where it was like, it was a grind, you know? Yeah. And so I would say that would be the second one. And then the last thing is don't ever underestimate the power of teamwork. But like, this was truly... I don't know of very many other situations where, you know, 18 plus countries, 1,000 people, every different religion, walk of life, language barriers, cultural barriers, that nobody like we were rallied together around a cause, right? And to truly see like what's possible when you work together and you can put aside the ridiculous biases and political biases and a lot of the other things people fight about these days and rally around a cause, like you truly can achieve impossible type things or things that used to be impossible that now we look at and say, well, maybe it is possible. We just need to look at it from a different angle. So
I got to know the elation at the end of this 18-day thing where first 50% of kids alive would have been success. And then ultimately you had the rational thought that, hey, one kid being alive would actually be success. Talk to me about the first 12 or 24 hours after you get these kids out. You touched real quickly on like what they said, like they just woke up in the hospital. And like, talk to me about you guys and your team after being wrung out so hard over that, but now actually having, I mean, I've been on some pretty successful missions in my career, nothing anywhere close to this. So I cannot imagine the feeling of you and your team when this happens. It's like in the movie Armageddon and the meteor's not hitting, you know what I mean?
That's what I was thinking, that same thing. I'm like,
it's like, holy cow.
So keep talking about Jason Bourne, but you just did the impossible. I'm just saying. So
the team, we were initially just kind of shocked that it worked, right? Yeah. Like, and having those emotions eventually started coming. Obviously we were extremely tired and catching up a little bit on some rest, but we were more shocked. And it was funny, the next day we all met and it was a very casual kind of dinner. And then, you know, I think once we truly realized, and it even took a few weeks after that to let it set in, you know, because sometimes you're so mission focused that when it's over, it's not like it's over. It's like, let me just turn the switch back off, you know? So it definitely took a while to set in, but I think we were just super prideful of the work, the teamwork that was put forth, you know? And I think something else that I thought was huge was that you didn't really see a lot of people try to take the spotlight after this, right? And I think that was huge. There was certain people that played certain roles, and there wasn't a lot of diminishing of if you were a guy building a high line, if you were a guy or girl at the field hospital, if you were Rick or John physically swimming the kids, like everybody was super humble about their role. And I thought that was really neat too, you know, that there wasn't a whole lot of people taking credit, that it was truly a team effort. And that's probably what I'll end on, unless you have more
questions. No, I mean, that's a great place to end. I think for our listeners, this is part of why we wanted to have this show, right? We've got incredible people across our formation. Now, Derek stepping in to be an instructor at the Joint Special Operations University for some of our senior enlisted folks. I mean, this is the caliber of folks that we have, humble, quiet professionals that when given the impossible task, there's 35 different steps that we talked over the last hour that were impossible. But when given an incredibly difficult problem, able to bite that thing off chunk by chunk with a great crew and able to literally do the impossible. A miracle. I don't know how to sum it up.
Yeah.
I don't think we're going to get any better than that as far as the value of teamwork and special operations coming together.
Yeah, and I'll end it, but Derek, just by saying that I think back to the first day you showed up to day 18, right, as we're starting to pull all the kids out,
yeah.
How the evolution of that problem and your approach to the problem changed. So there's always going to be this acute challenge facing you. And I think, Matt, you summed it up really well about, okay, stop, chunk by chunk, work together. And you know, what does the impossible look like? I think that's the quote of this show is, you know, show me what the impossible. So, hey, Derek, on behalf of General Clark and really all of us here at SOCOM, and a huge thanks. First of all, a huge thanks to you guys. We're so incredibly proud to be part of your team. But also, you know, thanks for everything you've done there. And you'll continue to do in your career, as you just got your career counseling from me an hour ago, right? So, I will say to our listeners again, thanks for listening. Be sure to tell your folks on your teams and your network and across the enterprise, you know, about what we do here at Softcast. You can reach us on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram. Listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, across the board. And you know, we're just really helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah. Derek, appreciate it. Thanks for joining us. Everyone out there listening, thanks. Please reach out. Give us your feedback, softcast@socom.mil. And take this moment, drop down, give us a 5-star review, and share it to your friends. And on behalf of all of us here at U.S. Special Operations Command, thanks for listening to Softcast.